tutti! Welcome to Engines of Creation podcast. I'm your host, Christian Mastrodonato. In this podcast, I bring together my knowledge in complex systems with my experience in managing technology innovation and new product development to explore how successful products, organizations, and ideas emerge. In these episodes, we're going to meet Luca Dell'Anna, an expert in people and operation management, and one of my favorite contemporary authors who can cover extremely complex topics, always providing clear and practical examples to relay them to our daily experience, as you will soon find out. In this conversation, we will mainly discuss about two of his books, which cover topics strictly related to the field of complexity. One book is titled Ergodicity, and it explains very clearly how this statistical physics and chaos theory concept has deep implication in our daily life and decisions. We will start from a practical example that will lead us to a clear definition, and we will learn what can be the strategy to keep non-ergodicity under control, in particular talking about the value of redistribution. Finally, in this part, we will discuss how ergodicity plays an important role in survival fitness, and that you have to push natural selection as deep as you can within you to have less chances that it will apply over you. In the second part, we'll discuss another of his books, Teams are Adaptive Systems, where we'll delve into the concept of complex adaptive systems and we'll learn how ethical and value-based behavior can provide a competitive advantage to managers. Furthermore, we will find out how feedback loops, so important to define intelligence in human beings and possibly also in artificial beings, play a good part in team management to avoid stupid behaviors. We will conclude by discussing how a leader who embraces complexity needs to focus on managing it rather than controlling it, by managing risks and looking at the adaptation she promotes. Unfortunately, in my quest to experiment new improved ways to record the interviews, the audio quality of my voice isn't great. I'm really sorry for that. But luckily, Luca's voice is much clearer, and that's all we need to learn all his marvelous insights. If you have any question about the topic covered by these episodes or anything else, feel free to reach out at engesofcreation@mastrodonato.com or DM me on my LinkedIn or Twitter profile, both C. Mastrodonato. Now it's time to dive into the great conversation with Luca Dell'Anna, so let's go! Ciao Luca, thank you very much for being here in Engines of Creation and being a guest for this new, I'm sure, very interesting episode.
Thank you so much for having me here.
That's great. So for the listener that don't know you yet, it probably would be great to have a bit of an introduction of yourself and what you do and your areas of focus and your research interests as well.
Yes, I'm a management advisor and I have more than 10 years of experience working with organizations, managers and entrepreneurs to improve their revenue and profitability through people management, operations management and better risk management. On the side of that, I also published some research and a few books, including the one on ergodicity and another one, which is called the Teams are Adaptive Systems.
To give the information to all our listeners, so actually you have published many other books, so they put a link to your website and people can also have a look to all the other books you've written that are really very interesting. But yeah, the two books you mentioned are going to be the books of focus of today's interviews, because I believe those are two more related to the concept of complexity and how complexity can be embraced and can be integrated into sort of daily management practices. So without any further ado, let's dive into one of the two core topics we're going to cover today, which is ergodicity. So you mentioned, you wrote a book that is actually titled Ergodicity. So you must know something about that. And I know it's a term that for people, for example, that comes with more statistical background, especially statistical physics, it's kind of a well-known term. But still, it is not well-known what are its implications into sort of our daily life, actually not even in business, but also personal life, to be fair. And I do believe that actually your book depicts very well what are these implications beyond the theory that's behind the term, really what are the practical implications. And it was a very interesting read for me. So I would really start with the first question for the people that are not very familiar with this term. What is ergodicity and why it matters for you?
Yeah, so in the book, I only define ergodicity in the second half of the book. So let me do the same thing here and let me begin with an example to show why it matters. And in the book, I begin with the example of a skier who is very good at skiing And therefore, he has a 20% chance of winning a ski race, but he also takes quite a few risks. And in each race, he also has a 20% chance of breaking his leg. And the question is, how many races is he expected to win in a championship of 10 races? And the naive answer would be 2 races, because we're saying that he has a 20% chance of winning each race. There are 10 races, and 20% multiplied 10 makes 2 races wins. However, that answer is wrong. And the reason why it's wrong is because if the skier breaks his leg during the first race, he forgoes the possibility to participate to the other races. So he has only an 80% chance of participating to the second race, and therefore only 80% times 20% makes 0.16, so a 16% chance of winning the second race. And he has an even lower chance of participating to the third race, and so on. And if we crunch the numbers, we discover that the expected number of wins over 10 races is only 0.71, which is much, much lower than the 2 wins that we would have expected if we didn't count, if we didn't take into account the fact that losses are irreversible. If he breaks his leg, it doesn't only mean that he loses that race, it means that he forgoes the possibility to winning each following race. So what is ergodicity? It turns out that in life, we have 2 kinds of situations. We have situations where losses are not irreversible and where losses do not absorb future gains. And these are situations that we call ergodic. And when something is ergodic, we can just take the average and we can extrapolate it over time. For example, we can say the average of wins over one race, 0.2. Therefore, over 10 races, I multiply that by 10 and it makes 2 races that I win. And then there are other situations in life which are non-ergodic, which are situations where consequences can be irreversible, where losses can absorb future gains. And therefore, you cannot just extrapolate an average over time. And these are situations which are non-ergodic. And why does it matter so much? Because in real life, nothing is ergodic. In real life, everything is non-ergodic. And there are considerations which do not matter in the short term, which have a big influence in the long term. For example, irreversible losses, the impact of learning, and other examples.
It's very nice starting from a practical example and then, of course, going into the definition. And I like very much this idea absorption barrier, because in that sense, it keeps an element sort of understanding what are the boundaries. And it is a concept that I've heard before reading your book. I came across personally reading Taleb. And actually, that was I also got curious when I saw your book, because that might be a place where I can get more answer on this front. There are a few things on this aspect I'd like maybe to touch in more details with you. I was listening actually to one of, I think was a presentation of yours at the Ergodicity Economics conference. And if I remember correctly, you were explaining that there is a sliding scale from a point of view of defining ergodicity. It's not necessarily binary in a way, but you can have a level of sort of being more or less ergodic or non-ergodic. And it would be interesting if you could elaborate more on that.
Yeah, exactly. If you read most economics and statistical papers, you will find the definitions of ergodicity which are binary. So something is either ergodic or non-ergodic. And if you're interested in the statistics behind it, I can recommend a paper called The Ergodicity Economics by Ole Peters. But in real life, nothing is ergodic. Everything is non-ergodic. Therefore, it doesn't make sense to think about ergodicity like, is it ergodic or non-ergodic? Because it's irrelevant, the distinction, if everything is non-ergodic. What we care about instead in real life is how non-ergodic is a process, which means concretely, how much it is affected by irreversibility, and how much does extending the process through time change its average. And in a lot of cases, for example, investing, we want actually the long term to be as close as possible to the average and not lower than that. Therefore, the right question is not how can I make an investment which is ergodic, because there is no such thing as an investment which is truly ergodic, but the better question is how can I make it more ergodic, which means how can I make sure that I have fewer irreversible losses, how can I make sure that when I continue in the long term, I lower the risk of game over, the risk of having drawdowns that are very hard to recoup, and so on. And in the book, for example, I discuss three strategies to make yourself, your activities, and so on more ergodic. And one, it's called the bubble strategy. Taleb already talks a bit in his book, Antifragile. And it's the idea that when you have an investment or an activity that has a risk of ruin or a risk of game over, you never fully expose to it fully. What you do instead is, for example, you invest 90% of your finances into investments that are as ergodic as possible. For example, in which the chances of game over are very low, the chances of big drawdowns are very low. And then instead, maybe you invest 10% of your finances into risk investments that have high upside, also high downside, but the high upside is so high that it more than compensates on average for the downside. The reason why the upside compensating for the downside on average is not enough, it's because even if it's true that maybe you have a 50% chance of the investment making you a millionaire and a 50% chance of the investment bringing you to zero, and the investment is 100,000 euros, for example, it's true that the average outcome is 500,000, very good. But as an individual, you want to look at the distribution of outcomes. And the distribution of outcomes where 50% you're a millionaire and 50% you go bankrupt might not be something desirable. So you only want to expose very little part of your finances to it, so that even if that part of the investment goes to zero, you still aren't in a very bad situation. So bubble strategy is the first strategy to make your investments more ergodic. The second one is skin in the game, which means you want to make sure that incentives are aligned, want to make sure that if there are bad actors, they get removed from the game pretty quickly. You want to make sure that if your process or investment relies on other people, those people are correctly aligned with you, and so on. And then the third strategy is redistribution, which is the idea that if you redistribute, you reduce the irreversibility of losses. And let me make a very simple example with numbers to explain this concept. Imagine that we play a game where you shoot a basketball free throw, which is a very simple shot. And if you make the shot, you double your money. And if you miss the shot, you half your money. And imagine that you are an average shooter with a chance of 50%. Okay, let's say 60%. So on average, you will think that shooting the ball would be a good bet. And you tried. First, let's say that you start with $100. First shot, the ball goes in, $200. Second shot, the ball goes out, and you half your money, and you go back to $100. Now, let's imagine that you play this game with a friend of yours. Your friend is very average. He has a 50% chance of making the basket, 50% chance of missing. However, this time, what you do is that you take one shot, he takes one shot, and then you pull your money together and you redistribute it 50-50. So let's imagine, first shot, you double your money and you go to $100. Your friend instead misses the basket and he halves his money and he goes to $50. Then we pull the money together, $200 plus $50 makes $250, and we split it 50-50. And each of us has $125. Then we make the second shot. As in the previous example, I miss it and I half my money, and from $125, I go back to $62. And my friend makes the basket, he doubles his money, from $125, he goes to $250. Then we pull the money together. 250 plus 62 makes 312. We split the money 50-50, and I end up with $156. You see, now my performance is the same one as before. I made one shot and I missed the shot. The rules are the same. If you make the shot, you double your money. If you miss it, you half it. And yet, now I increased my money. In the previous example where I was playing without redistribution, I went back to $100. In the example where I'm playing with redistribution, I'm up to $156. So this is the power of redistribution. It reduces the amount in which losses are irreversible. Only also works if you redistribute with people that are less good than you at increasing money. Of course, up to a measure. If the person is complete terrible and doesn't make a single shot, then of course not. But up to a certain measure, redistribution helps, even if you redistribute with people who are less good than you. And the practical way in which it can happen to real life, because maybe you don't want to redistribute with other people, is that you redistribute between investments. And an example that I had a conversation a couple of times in my life is sometimes I meet people who work in startups and they have a big chunk of the net worth in stock in the company they work for, stock or stock options. And they are very excited about it because company is growing very fast, everything looks good, and they expect to become multimillionaires in a few years. And sometimes I tell them, maybe you should think about diversifying your investments. And they're like, yes, but what do I diversify it with? Any other investment that is available to me has a lower expected return than the stock in my company. And this is true. However, the problem is that their bet in their company is concentrated, which means that they have, okay, quite a good chance of becoming a multimillionaire, but also non-negligible chance of losing all their money. Whereas if they diversify, let's say 50% of their stock, they sell it and they buy the stock market or bonds or something generic, let's say, it's true that if the company goes well, they will still be multimillionaire, less multi than before, but still multimillionaire, so very good outcome. And if the company doesn't get a good outcome, maybe the stock goes to zero. Well, because they diversified, maybe they're still millionaire, maybe they even something more than that. So diversification works even if you're diversifying with something which is less performant than what you're giving up. And yeah, so these are three strategies to manage non-ergodicity.
That's brilliant. Thank you very much. That's really interesting, all these strategies. And as you mentioned, definitely the barbell strategy and the skin in the game, they've been well depicted in your book. And of course, they've been also widely discussed by Taleb. I personally find very interesting that there is distribution one. Disclaimer here, of course, we're not investment manager and we're having a conversation, so don't necessarily follow.
Yeah, of course, nothing is investment advice, of course.
Which is a joke, but not really. There are some fundamental truth. And one element I really like also on the redistribution is that there are possibly wider economical implications beyond your own investments. And there is an element where actually it can be easily claimed that most, if not all, of our modern economics and financial theory is based on the assumption that the systems are ergodic. But as we know, they are not. With this assumption, we also go towards the consequence that competition is believed to be the best way to have a performing market. But actually, in a non-ergodic environment, redistribution and cooperation might be the most efficient way to have overall economic advantage.
Let me just say one thing. They are not at odds. You can have competition with some redistribution, which I would argue that it's probably the best system.
Completely agree with you. Completely agree. And that's the point. So they're definitely not at odds, but there is an element where often redistribution is perceived as not economically efficient. But actually, this view shows that maybe redistribution actually provides economic efficiency as well. as well as competition, and a healthy combination of the two could be an interesting way to approach this thing. So for anybody interested in this conversation, of course, Chris, and you mentioned already the paper from Ole Peters, Connectivity Economics, and people can find online, I think it's called The Farmer Fable, which is another nice example that shows in a more agricultural environment how there's distribution works. And it's something probably there is YouTube video or some games online or something like that. So it is also something that I would suggest people to look at if they're more interested in this topic. Before closing with the conversation about ergodicity, there is another element that I find interesting about ergodicity. Sort of ergodicity can help a system to become fitter. What I mean with that is that local failure, it's important to improve the survival fitness of the system. And that's something that we can find in evolution theory, in genetics. But sometimes I would argue that something that has also a management implication, and there is a lot about being able to fail within the limit that you fail in an ergodic way. So I would like to hear your take this point of view as well.
Yeah, the thing is that like natural selection is inevitable. And you can see it in markets in this way. In a market, there are multiple companies. And over time, it's inevitable that the worst companies, they go bankrupt and they disappear and the better companies survive. Natural selection also applies to the layer below it. So in the company, there are multiple products. And over time, the worst products disappears together with the teams working on it maybe, and the best product thrive. Same thing applies within the team. In the team, there are more performing and less performing employees. And to some extent, the lower performing employee, at some point they quit or they are laid off and so on. Natural selection is kind of inevitable. What you can do, however, is influence the level at which it applies. If you apply some level of natural selection within your team, you avoid natural selection at the layer above you. And if your company applies some natural selection within you, you avoid the chance that natural selection applies over you so that the company disappears. Now, of course, however, this, how I said, it sounds a bit cruel because we don't want to lay off people. The key is to understand that there is natural selection also within people. People are containers of beliefs and habits. Some of those are efficient, some of those are less efficient. And if I manage to make natural selection happen within me, so at the level of understanding which of my beliefs and habits are problematic, then I reduce the chances that natural selection will happen over me. For example, that I get fired by my company. So a lot of what you want to do is to acknowledge, one, that natural selection is inevitable, and two, you want to try to push natural selection as deep as possible within you so that it doesn't happen over you. And I argue, and I make this point in my book called The Power of Adaptation, I argue that part of the job of ourselves as individuals is to try to surface needs for adaptation within us before not adapting leads to for us to problems which are too big. And the same applies to managers. And I think that managers, part of the job of manager, is to make adaptation happen within their people before it happens over them and they have maybe to lay off people.
I really like this answer because that's really the point about improvement at team level, self-improvement, which is building blocks of anything, especially when you look at things from the lens of continuous improvement. To be fair, also your answer, it helps us to connect very, very nicely to the second half of this interview that wants to focus more on team management and the nature of teams as complex adaptive systems. So you wrote a book about that, about this topic. And again, similarly bit with ergodicity, people are not necessarily familiar maybe with the definition of what the complex adaptive systems is. So it would be nice again to hear from your point of view, what is a complex adaptive system and why teams are a complex adaptive system?
Yeah, so my definition of an adaptive system, it's a system in which the direct outcomes of an action matter much less than how the system adapts to the action. And to explain concretely what I mean, one of the advice I generally give to managers is take decisions not just for their direct outcome, but also for how your team will adapt to your decision. Because in the long term, how your team adapts to your decision is what is most likely to matter. And that change of perspective, like, is very important when you decide, for example, on whether to call out or not someone, whether to reward or not someone, whether to be fair or to address an immediate urgency, and so on. Because, for example, imagine that you have an important person in your team, a good performer, you never gave a raise, and then one day they come to your office and they say, either you give me a raise or I quit. And of course, you should have given him a raise much earlier than that. That said, in that moment, you might think, oh, I should give him a raise because I cannot afford him to leave. However, what's the adaptation that will happen in your team? The adaptation is that everyone will learn that the way that you get a raise in this company is by giving an ultimatum. And tomorrow, you will get everyone on their LinkedIn. And in 1 week, you will get an ultimatum from all of your team. So, of course, you should do a lot of work in rewarding your people before it's too late. But that's an example of what I mean by you should consider how the team adapts to your decision. Another example is when you decide whether to call out someone because they're doing something wrong. Maybe they're skipping a corner. And maybe you might think, oh, I shouldn't call them out because we are in a rush. Or we are about to miss a deadline. So I will just ignore him taking a shortcut now. But the question is, how will your team adapt to it? They will learn that taking shortcuts is allowed. And that's definitely not an adaptation that you want to have in your team. And towards the second half of the book, I show how, for example, if you as a manager, you try to live by a single principle, which is always be fair, then naturally, everything else which is good and management will descend from this. Because you can only be fair if you are clear. You can only be fair if you give good and early feedback. You can only be fair if you keep people accountable. You can only be fair if you reward good job. You can only be fair if you... Basically, if you really want to be fair, you need to do everything else which makes a good manager.
Yeah, very, very, very important point. And I like very much from my perspective that looking at teams management from complex adaptive system shows how ethical behaviors from managers actually create rewards, which I would argue I've been lucky personally in my career, been in many places where maybe that was obvious, but I've heard of situations where this is not that obvious. And then actually having clear explanation that shows that, well, ethical behavior gives you a competitive advantage, to me, it's a very important point.
Like, a good question is, why don't we have ethical and fair behavior in companies? And part of the reason is because, yes, some people are bad people, and that's part of the answer. But part of the answer is also because people are afraid that if they take an ethical choice, which brings a long-term reward, but has a short-term cost, their own boss will hold them accountable for the short-term cost before the long-term benefit appears. I give an example. I see that one of my people on the manufacturing line are doing something which is unsafe. And I am a good person, and I would want to stop them and teach them how to properly use the equipment and maybe buy some better safety equipment for them. However, I also think that maybe if my manager learns that I stopped production for 20 minutes because I was explaining and then I incurred some costs because I bought some better equipment, I might be afraid that my manager will hold this against me. And so, in many times in the company, the bottleneck is, how do you get your people to trust that you really want them to be ethical, even when it's bad for the company in the short term? Because a lot of times when the CEO says, we need to be ethical, we need to think about safety, we need to think about all the core values, people are, in the back of their mind, they think, Yes, but do you really mean that? Do you really expect me to take the costly choice in the short term? How can I trust that if I take the costly choice in the short term, I won't be held accountable for it? And CEOs in particular, they need to demonstrate that. And the only way in which they can demonstrate is by taking costly actions themselves. For example, if they visit the manufacturing line and they take their precious and costly time to wear the proper safety equipment, that's a strong signal that they really expect people to lose a bit of time in productivity to wear the safety equipment, for example.
It is a very relevant point, and thanks for jumping in and specifying that, because this gives also that perspective again that there is an alignment of values, and everybody stick to that. And the higher it is, the more alignment is expected. A side note, which I believe is kind of covered also with the safety example in a way, but I'd like to dig down a bit more. Most of your examples are about operational excellence, which of course I know it's a big focus of yours and a big focus also of your advisory activities. But do we expect to have the same positive results also from a strategic alignment point of view, and therefore more aligning the teams towards strategic objectives?
So it's partially relevant to strategic alignment in the sense that doing that will not by itself guarantee strategic alignment. But if you don't do that and you start having bad adaptations or lack of the good adaptations in your team, then even if you achieve strategic alignment, it will be extremely hard to execute on it. Also, in some companies, the problem is not much achieving strategic alignment in theory, but preventing it from dissolving into misalignment later on when people start taking choices that go against the main strategy. And this is, again, something to consider, because very often when you see the first step away from the strategy, so the first hint of misalignment, the question is, do you address it or do you let it pass? And if you let it pass, everyone else will adapt in the way that they will think that strategic alignment maybe is not so important as you make it seem. And then things go downhill. So this is, in my opinion, the relationship with strategic alignment.
Yeah. Okay, so I'd like to move to an aspect of teams are complex analytic systems that made our connection. I really like to explore them more with you and see whether they make sense or not. One of the key elements that you point out as a core activity for a manager is creating tight feedback loops. And you can see that level of approach in other practices around continuous improvement and so forth. But I'd like to take, not necessarily a metaphor, but more as analogy, with intelligent systems, okay? In the sense that in a way we can expect teams of any given size, I would say beyond two, to behave as complex system. And complex systems, they tend to show emergent behaviors. Now, there are thinkers, and I'm referring here, for example, to Hofstadter and his beautiful book called Eschenbach, but also the work that Giulio Tononi has been doing over the years, but many others. I'm just giving two names. So there is a lot of theoretical thinking that shows how intelligence might be linked to recursive systems and complex systems that have a lot of recursive behavior. So the connection I'm having here is tight systematic feedback and tight feedback loop a way to build intelligence within your complex system, in that case made of humans and made of people that create your team, or maybe it's too much of this analogy?
So I definitely think that recursivity is necessary for intelligence. And one example would be just if you look at our own brain, at the cortex, how much of the links between the neurons are actually recursive, how much information is sent back as feedback, because it's critical to have information to propagate back, to offer context, and so on. Now, to your analogy of how does recursivity applies to teams, I don't think necessarily that it's necessary for intelligence, but I think that it's necessary to prevent stupidity. Meaning that with a team, you don't need only intelligence, you need intelligence which is aligned with the goals of the organization. And if there is no feedback, you will get something that degenerates extremely quickly. Part of the role of the feedback is to keep things aligned. Another part of all of the feedback is to help learning faster. So if you look at the cortex, one of the ways in which we learn sequences, and sequences are at the basis of almost everything we learn, because if you think about it, language is a sequence. It's a sequence of sounds. Thoughts in our mind are a sequence of actions or manipulations. Even, for example, if you observe a bottle of water, what you're seeing is not like an image, but you're seeing a succession of features, because our eyes move around the different parts of the bottle. And we learn that when we see, for example, a cap, which is followed below by some plastic, which is followed inside by some liquid, and so on, we have a bottle. So sequences are extremely important. One of the ways in which our brain learns, and there is a beautiful book on this, which is called 1,000 Brains by Jeff Hawkins. Basically, he's showing how the role of feedback, in a way, is to make sure that neurons understand the meaning of what they are perceiving. For example, that if a neuron, now I'm making some simplification, but in easy words, if a neuron sees a cap, he knows, sees a bit of hard plastic, he knows that this is in the context of a bottle. And what he's seeing is it's a cap, for example. And you can only do that through feedback. And back to this example of managers, if you as a manager, you are able to explain the context and the meaning of the decisions and the situations that your subordinates are facing, you will be able to grow them, their skills and their judgment so much faster.
I like the way you replied to my analogy about more something against stupidity versus the creation of intelligence, and made me think about the Schiller quote that also Asimov quoted out about against stupidity, the gods themselves contend in vain. Also, to be fair, for our podcast listeners, of course, they are missing the fact that every time that Luca was talking about the bottle, he was actually showing me a bottle. I'll maybe urge you to think it back really with this bottle in your mind. But thanks a lot. It's a very, very interesting answer. And it creates, of course, a lot of other relationship. And yes, to be fair, 1,000 Brains, it's a book that is in my stack of books that I have to read, which is usually always too big. There is the Taleb's references to the Eco's library, Umberto Eco's library, as a library that you will never be able to read. And I feel, yes, I have a similar situation on my side. I'd like to close with a question that I becoming a fixture of this podcast. And the question is, what are for you the characteristics of a leader that wants to embrace complexity?
So for me, the key characteristic would be an attitude of not trying to understand complexity, but managing it. By this, I mean that complexity, by its own definition, is extremely complex. And I don't think that you can really understand everything in complex systems. There will be always something that you miss. There will always be a blind spot. So don't try to understand complexity. Instead, try to manage it. And by this, I mean, you want to have some sound risk management. You want to take a bit of redundancy rather than optimization. So, of course, you want to optimize, but only optimize up to a certain point, so that even if there was something you didn't understand, even if the complex system behaves in a way that you didn't predict, you are still okay. So I think that this is part of the attitude. Then to understand the complex system that's been there before, something which is very important is to look at people who've been there for a long time. What did they do? What they didn't do? What helped them stay in the game for so long? These are, I think, very important attitudes. And then, of course, you want to always think like in the long term, like what I was saying before, like you want to consider like what are the adaptations that your actions are promoting in others, in yourself.
Thank you. These are all relevant attitudes. And I like your point about managing complexity because, well, at the end, this is sort of the leitmotiv, I would say, of Engines of Creation podcast, and which is trying to fight against the tendency to control everything, managing things, and especially in the case of complexity, by definition, you can't really predict a complex system, and you need to be able to create heuristics that allows you to navigate it and react accordingly. And I believe during today's conversation with you, actually, you gave us a lot of practical ways to approach it and to become better leaders. So thank you very much, Luca. It was really a pleasure to talk to you today. And I suggest to all the listeners to go to your website and read your books because they are really worth it. So thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Christian.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Engines of Creation. I hope you enjoyed learning from Luca how ergodicity and complex adaptive systems play such an important role in our lives. If you did, and you want to learn more, be sure to follow Engines of Creation and leave us a rating and a review, please. And if you have any question, comment or feedback, feel free to reach out to engensofcreation@mastrodonato.co or DM me on my LinkedIn or Twitter profiles. Both see Mastro Donato. Arrivederci!